learning about different people's journeys and what are the gaps in the system. And you've been able to see that with the different spaces that you occupy and use your voice to create avenues for folks to be heard and create avenues for policies and changes to come about so that we're not going to continue to perpetuate harm. We're not going to continue to marginalize folks. And we're going to actually try to improve the healthcare system. And that really just starts with what we use our voices and our time to do.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital. I'm your host, Candace, and each episode we share the powerful stories of transplant recipients and living donors, along with insights and education from leading medical professionals. Today, we're diving into an important and sometimes uncomfortable topic, racism in healthcare and advocacy, and the fear that many people in systematically repressed communities feel when navigating the healthcare system. Joining me is Kamika Sylvester, a nurse, patient, and founder of Rennell Co., an organization dedicated to advocacy, storytelling, and breaking down barriers in healthcare through creativity and lived experience. She opens up about what advocacy really means, how historical and ongoing inequities continue to shape care experiences, and why rebuilding trust between healthcare systems and systematically repressed communities starts with listening, empathy, and representation. This conversation is a reminder that health equity isn't just a policy, it's personal. Let's dive in. Welcome back to the Living Transplant Podcast. It is my true excitement and joy to have Kamika here with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Candace.
So I'm really lucky because we've seen each other a few times recently. But for listeners who don't know you, I'm wondering if you could start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about your personal journey and your professional journey and how it really brought you into patient advocacy and discussing things like racism in healthcare.
Yes, for sure. Before I was a nurse, consultant, nonprofit founder, and now like tech founder, I was a patient first, and that journey started when I was 18 and diagnosed with a tumor that I had no symptoms of and found out that it was because of an administrative error by my pediatrician that it wasn't caught sooner. And all of a sudden, I'm graduating high school, getting excited to go to McMaster, but instead of enjoying that excitement, I'm having meetings with neurosurgeons, specialists, my doctor doing blood work, and trying to figure out what my care plan is going to be and how it's going to impact the rest of my life. So I didn't really have a choice in terms of becoming an advocate. My mom had to shoulder the burden of seeing her daughter's trajectory change in a single doctor's appointment and still be strong. But I knew that this journey was going to be challenging potentially for a number of reasons. I'm a young Black woman, so the way that I see the world and navigate the healthcare system is a bit different than others. So while I was at McMaster, I did a case study on myself and learned as much as I could about what was happening in my condition. And then I was able to have these conversations with these healthcare providers using the same language that they're using, and it changed everything. So with everything that I've learned over the past, I don't want to, you know, say my age, but
it's been a while. It's been a minute
of navigating this system with this diagnosis. I've learned a lot that I've then kind of channeled that into different avenues to share that with other patient groups from different racialized groups and create learning materials so that people that are going through things like this and navigating our complex healthcare system don't have to struggle as much, and they can truly learn how to be advocates for themselves in a system that was not built for them. So that's where my passion stems from. And now I'm using everything that all the privilege that I have now being a nurse, having gone to university and learned a lot about the medical field and the science field, and while working in the system as well and on the administrative end to truly help change the trajectory of people's healthcare journeys.
That's amazing. I mean, you know, thinking about that, being so young, being, you know, thrown into this system with no prior knowledge, like you're a kid, that's a lot to go through. And then, you know, using all of your knowledge to turn around and, you know, help others. I absolutely appreciate and love all of the doctors and nurses who are lucky enough to not have had to have that personal knowledge. But I think there's such power in people who have been through something that then turn around and make that change in the system that they saw that wasn't good enough. And they're going to say, I'm going to go make that change because I didn't see it for myself. And I don't want the people who are behind me to have to go through what I just did. Like, that's amazing to then take that and run with it. And I'm wondering if you can talk about some of those reasons why people may fear doctors and avoid seeking care and maybe think that, you know, this system is not built for me. The people in it don't look like me. They're not talking the same language. You know, they're using all these acronyms that don't make any sense. And how you've really begun to adapt how you work in that system and change things from within.
Definitely. I think that the history of like mistrust and trauma in the healthcare system is very deep rooted for many groups for so many different reasons. We have, you know, instances of racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and other types of oppression and discrimination in our system that have truly impacted the way that a lot of us navigate and see, you know, our healthcare system. So you add colonialism and different historical events or contexts like slavery and how, for example, like within the Black community, there are published papers that Black people don't feel pain the same way, that we have different receptors that in terms of like our ability to perceive pain, essentially that we're quote unquote superhuman to some degree, which they then use that research to justify experimenting on Black bodies without anesthesia and just a lot of atrocities that have been passed on for generations and generations that have breeded a lot of mistrust within our community and so many others that we are essentially now having to try to undo a lot of generational trauma and support patients who have had lived experiences very recently in our current system that still have many of the same themes of dismissal, of, you know, misdiagnosis, of discrimination that essentially should not have happened under any circumstances. But unfortunately, we can't change the past, but I'm very focused on how can we make the future better for those patients. So for me, I try to work on both sides in terms of one, helping the patients and empowering them, providing them with knowledge and tools that they can use to advocate for themselves. And then also speaking to healthcare providers and looking at what are the different factors, whether that be bias, whether that be burnout, and things that are contributing to the harm that's being done. While also, I guess on a third level, advocating to the different powers that control our healthcare system, whether that be our provincial government, the senior leadership of healthcare organizations, of hospitals and long-term care homes and different facilities. So it's very complex and there's a lot of different avenues that I'm trying to use to improve the healthcare system for not just me and my community, but all of us can benefit from health equity being at the forefront of our healthcare system.
Amazing. Yeah. Thinking about it, it's not just one scope, right? It's all of these layers. It's like onion layers of all of these pieces that need to come together. You know, for me, I try to think about what are these steps that I can take with the privilege that I have. And, you know, I've done some specific cultural training. Like I did the Sonia's cultural training, which I felt like was really impactful. Like it really hit me for a few days. It was difficult to digest it all and realize that this is the country that I live in and the history that has been here. And we're not taught that. I mean, hopefully my child will learn a lot more. Like she's 4 and she already knows about residential schools, which is incredible that she has that history. But I wasn't taught any of that in high school. Like I don't remember any of it. So, you know, thinking about this diversity training or cultural safety training, how do you feel that it works in healthcare? Like sometimes I feel like it doesn't always translate into real change. What do you think real cultural safety in healthcare looks like to you?
I think that we overcomplicate things sometimes. I think that cultural safety training is imperative. Like I too did the training as well, the Sonia's, and learning about the history and having that understanding truly can be transformational. However, it's only transformational if we've actually addressed bias, if we've actually looked at our heart posture when it comes to walking in to the healthcare system as care providers. Because sometimes people can learn these things but still dismiss the history, right? So it's actually looking at the attitudes that you hold, the bias that you may have, and what is your approach. And I think that where sometimes resources may be limited in terms of being able to sit down and complete trainings like this across the board for so many different groups, I think having an understanding at the basic level that one, people have trauma, and a lot of it is through no fault of their own. It's systemic, looking at like, what does oppression look like in our system, and looking at the intersectionalities of people's identities and how does that impact the way that they have experienced the world and what they're coming in with. And then looking at privilege and power, being in a privileged position a lot of times is also no fault of your own. So having that sense of responsibility to then understand that you're caring for a person that has trauma that has affected the way that they see the world, looking at your power and privilege and using that to see that person as an individual from a holistic view and treating them with basic dignity. It really is that simple. As a human being, regardless of what they've gone through, regardless of who they are, they deserve respect. They deserve to be listened to. They deserve to be cared for. And they deserve access to care that is culturally sensitive. And you do not have to know all of the things that they've gone through before that point. You simply have to ask questions. You know, we are taught to be, as healthcare providers, we're taught to be observant, to critically think, to look at body language, to use all the information that is being told to us and in front of us to make decisions. So use those same skills. If you notice that they're a little bit apprehensive, if you notice that they're guarded, if you notice that they're fearful, they're shy, they're withdrawn, think about what could be causing that. Ask questions and be sensitive to it. It really doesn't have to be overly complicated. I think that treating people with basic human dignity goes a long way, but we don't think about it like that sometimes. And we instead try to push cultural competency, which is impossible. It is impossible for you to be competent in every single culture that exists.
For sure. Yeah.
Right? And then we then end up treating groups like a monolith, where it's like, oh, like I've learned this about the Black community, so that means every single Black person or every Indigenous person feels this way. Absolutely not. And then we can end up generalizing and then further stereotyping, mm-hmm. even though our intentions may be good. So I think that learning as much as you can is never a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that at the bare minimum, ask questions and treat the person in front of you. It's that simple.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. You know, you're getting to know the person instead of, you know, what is on a list in a chart, right? You're getting to know that person. I had a conversation with a patient maybe a year and a half ago, and I was chatting with them about dialysis and, you know, how they were doing. And, you know, we were chatting about general things, but the goal was really to get to know them a little bit so that I can pair them with a mentor. That's what they had asked for. I want to talk to somebody who's been on dialysis, been through the process of transplant. But I want to talk to somebody that would make me feel comfortable. And of course, we're really lucky that we have our ACB Organ Health Committee at the center, and we have amazing people who are part of that. And you've been on their Green Table Talk, which is awesome. And it was interesting because I said, you know, what is one thing that would make you feel more comfortable coming into dialysis every day? And, you know, I always think from me being a dialysis patient, like maybe it's something like a blanket or, you know, having a podcast to listen to or whatever those simple things were. And he looked at me and he said, you know, it'd be really nice if I actually saw somebody else in this dialysis unit that looked like me. And he said, I'm not talking about patients. I'm talking about my dialysis nurses. And that hit me really hard, you know, thinking about how he goes into center 3 times a week for 4 to 5 hours. That's a big chunk of his life. And he's sitting there thinking to himself, nobody who is caring for me looks like me. And I was wondering, you know, from your perspective, how does having somebody like this patient, having a Black healthcare professional with them through their journey, impact that trust and that outcome and, you know, the journey that he's having?
I think that there's so much value in having a diverse healthcare workforce for that reason. It's that feeling of safety. It's that feeling of shared culture, language, values, that breath of fresh air when somebody walks in that looks like you and you're like, okay, like you feel seen.
Mm.
I think that it's truly something that we have to work on, increasing representation.
Mm-hmm.
And there is data that shows that there are more improved health outcomes, not just for racialized patients, but for all patients when they are treated by a care team that is more diverse. Having consultations with a dietitian that understands like your cultural foods, it can help create a plan for you based off of your needs. And that work is being done, but a lot of times that burden is very heavy because there are not many of us in the spaces. So it's the more specialized you go in terms of different disciplines and specialties, the representation goes down significantly. And for patients like the one that you were speaking to, it truly can feel like isolating. You don't feel seen, and you're spending a huge portion of your life sitting in a chair being cared for by folks not feeling seen, which can have poor mental health outcomes. It can have, like you said, lower adherence to care plans because you're not having advice or consultations with folks mm-hmm. that truly understand your lived experiences in your day-to-day. So I think that it is very important. It is also why I chose to venture off with Code Melanin, which is my tech startup that's actually looking at addressing burnout for Black, Indigenous, and racialized healthcare providers, so that those of us who are at the forefront of healthcare don't leave because of burnout or discrimination, because so few of us are already in these spaces. We truly can't afford, with such a diverse population that require care, to have any of us leave. And then we also want to increase recruitment, increase opportunities for mentorship, so that, you know, maybe there will be more folks that want to go into dialysis nursing because mm-hmm. they see other people that look like them who are encouraging them to do it, which will result in a lot more patients feeling seen. So I'm trying to look at where are the gaps. I think, like, you know, like ACB group, there's a lot of patient supports and initiatives targeting supporting racialized patients, but the healthcare provider side is a little bit lagging behind. So that's where I'm trying to fill the gaps there so that we do have representation because it matters.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's where I always go is, you know, how do I support patients? Because I'm one of them, right? And I've been doing this work now for years, and I've had my transplant for 16 years. So I always go, you know, my brain goes to patients first, but you know, there's so much burnout in healthcare. And, you know, if there's not support for both sides, it's not going to work out, right? So that's brilliant that you're looking at that journey that healthcare professionals go through. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that. Like, do you, how is your network? Like, how have you talked to a lot of nurses and healthcare professionals who are going through that, like thinking about leaving the field because of that burnout and that fatigue?
Definitely. I think with COVID, one of the positive things that came out of it was it thrust nursing and other healthcare providers into the spotlight. Our experiences, our day-to-day, we were seen as quote-unquote healthcare heroes, but being treated sometimes like as dispensable, like as just bodies there to do a work without really considering what that, how heavy that burden is. And a lot of us got into this career to help people. So a lot of times that comes with sacrificing things like sleep, your mental health, just for the sake of making sure that, you know, your unit isn't short-staffed and that patients don't suffer, because you know that if you don't show up that day, or if you show up and you're not your best, that you potentially could impact someone's healthcare journey and cause trauma in the system. So I've had the privilege and the pleasure of being able to travel to different parts of Canada, some of them very remote, small communities, as a travel nurse in the emergency department. So I've got to meet a lot of different nurses, and oftentimes the conversation when we're sitting amongst ourselves is, what drew you to travel nursing? Like, what was it like back at your home hospital? And a lot of us shared stories of the burnout, the being overworked and underpaid and feeling dismissed and choosing this as a choice for themselves. It still doesn't make it any easier in terms of like the compensation, but you do feel like you're making a difference, because sometimes you're going out to rural communities that their emergency department would have been closed if you were there. Right. And you're truly feeling like you're making an impact. So it's the stories that I've heard about burnout, the things that I've experienced even myself as a nurse who unfortunately was burnt out very quickly in my career, and having to make choices on my day, like in my day to day, that helped keep me refreshed, because I personally believe that no patient deserves the worst version of me at work. And that if I'm not operating at 100%, I'm not going to interact with patients and then cause more trauma, because I know that one interaction with me can lead to years of fear, dismissal, like, and mistrust in a system that they might already be hesitant about being in. So for me, that's what really fueled my journey, is like seeing how we're all in the same boat, regardless of where, what provinces we were coming from, what units we were coming from, that our healthcare system truly is fragmented and broken across the board. And how can we advocate on a higher level to make those changes on both sides for patients and healthcare providers? Because as on the patient side, I've seen what it's like when, you know, I'm being cared for by somebody who probably shouldn't be at the bedside, because for a number of reasons. But me having the experience of being on the other side, I can give the benefit of the doubt or speak up or be sensitive to that. but mm-hmm. a lot of people can't, and they shouldn't have to be to some degree, mm-hmm. because a lot of us don't want to be patients.
Right.
A lot of us didn't ask for this. So
yeah,
we're not going into the hospital by choice. So I think that that's very important to know and to be sensitive to.
Amazing. You know, we have different people who listen to this podcast. If you know, there's somebody out there who's young in their career, or, you know, they're the type that we just listened to, like, go, 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 like you are. And, you know, they're looking for some ideas or some tips about how to prevent that burnout and how to make sure that, you know, they keep the fire of the passion for caring for people, but also still taking care of themselves. What are some things that you would suggest to them?
I think, like in many cases with preventative measures and health promotion, we can actually go back to the basics. I hosted an event through my nonprofit, the Black Birth Project and Code Melanin, about brain health and looking at the intersections of brain health, burnout, and a sense of belonging amongst Black, Indigenous, and racialized, not just healthcare providers, but researchers and students. And essentially, the impact of working in the healthcare system, being burnt out on your brain, can be very detrimental to your overall mm-hmm. health if you're not proactive. So we talked about essentially getting back to basics. What does your body need to function? You need at least 6 hours of sleep. So putting, you know, plans in place to try your best, it's not always easy, to get at least that much sleep, especially before you're going into a shift, because the outcomes in terms of your brain and your nervous system are very poor. We also talked about, what are you eating? How are you fueling your body? And the impact of your diet, right? The impact of exercise and your brain chemistry, and looking at, you know, your dopamine, looking at your serotonin, looking at different chemical imbalances in your brain based off of the decisions that you're choosing. There are so many different ways that we can, despite working shift work, despite, you know, a lot of times experiencing higher levels of trauma than the general public, because we're caring for folks that have lived experiences, that are going through very challenging and even scary, terrifying journeys. How can we mitigate some of the challenges of being a healthcare worker? And it really involves going back to basics: diet, exercise, having different plans in place for your mental health and resources available to you. So that could look like therapy, that could look like journaling, that could look like practicing mindfulness, and knowing when to step away. So being very self-aware and in touch with your body and like what you're feeling, mm-hmm. and being able to take a second to pause, whether that means taking a day off, whether that means, I know for me, like I will go into our supply closet and just deep breathe for a second if maybe I'm, you know, feeling overwhelmed with what's going on in the day. Or sometimes, as someone who's also a patient, I'm very empathetic. And when my patients are crying and I'm holding their hand, I'm truly trying not to cry with them because I know what that feels like. Oh. So sometimes I need to step away so that I can also just like process everything that's going on, while also noticing the system, right? Having a patient in the hallway, that lack of dignity, the budget constraints and how that impacts care. So I see the system level as well, which can also be so frustrating because there's not much that I can do about that.
Yeah.
So I truly have to take a second a couple times during my shift and during the day. But I do encourage anyone who's young in their career to really look at the choices that you're making in your health. Find a mentor, find a place to work that aligns as closely as possible with your values, and a team. I'm very fortunate right now to work on a unit with a team and management that truly see patients as people, that truly are doing their best to support all patients and are empathetic. And our job is very difficult. I work on a very busy unit, but it truly does not feel as overwhelming. I can say that I'm not burnt out right now because I know that we all are doing our best to care for patients and see them as people. So I recommend finding a place to start your career that truly will align with those values that are the reason why you got into that position in the first place.
That's great advice. My 4-year-old learned this thing at school that I've been doing recently, and she we're on a podcast, so you can't see it, but basically, like, she traces her hand, and as her finger goes up her finger, she breathes in, and then as it goes down into the next, depth of your next finger, she breathes out, and so she does it 5 times, like, all along her finger when she gets worked up at school. And I stole it. And when I'm having rough days, I'm like, okay, just grab, take your one finger and breathe in and out on your hand 5 times. And it just really, it seems so silly and so simple, but it really does help. Like you said, those basics. And when you're in those stressful situations and, the most powerful doctors and surgeons and, the most impressive people who I have interviewed for this podcast, all of them have said what you said as well. And the biggest piece that a lot of them harp on is that mentorship piece. Like, find somebody who has done this before, who is still, moved by patients and connected and empathetic with them and still loves their job, and ask them those questions. Like, how did you get here? What have you done to have 40 years in this business? And, how do you stay calm? How do you stay grounded? All of those amazing things. It's anybody who I talk to, who is on the right path will say that, find a mentor who can support you through that journey. So it's amazing to hear all of these things. And I'm wondering if we can pop back to, the patient side of things. I've been a beneficiary of listening to your presentations a few times for patients, and one of the things you talk about are the ABCs of advocacy. And I love it because it's so simple to remember. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your ABCs and how we really empower patients and their families to advocate for themselves in a medical system that sometimes doesn't feel safe for them.
For sure. I think that it's very overwhelming going into these different interactions. So if I can simplify something, because I know for me, I have the memory of a goldfish, but I think we can all remember our ABCs. So the A is for adjust your attitude and really doing that check-in with yourself as to, like, what am I bringing into this interaction that may hinder me from truly participating and engaging with my healthcare provider in a productive way. So giving your healthcare provider or whoever it is that you're meeting with the benefit of the doubt, but still being vigilant and checking in with yourself throughout that interaction, but just giving the benefit of the doubt and going in there with a positive mindset, because most people in this field did not get into the healthcare system to harm you. They truly, we want to help. The B is for bringing backup. I think that there's so much value in having somebody with you, whether that's on the phone. Sometimes, like, there's language barriers, or, I know with my grandmother, like, I love going to her appointments with her, so that I can also be a second ear, a voice. So it shouldn't be this way, but also, like, having someone in the family that works in the healthcare system is really valuable, because I think sometimes by default they use, like you said, acronyms and medical terminology and forget to simplify it. And when you're not by yourself, you just when you're by yourself, you kind of feel the need to move things along. So you may not read like you understand and you don't. So having another layer of accountability for them and someone else that can advocate for you in real time is very, very valuable.
I remember recently, sorry, I remember recently my dad was in the hospital. He was diagnosed with heart failure, and thankfully I was in the room when the cardiologist came in and I listened, and then my dad said, "Okay, thanks." And I looked at my dad and I said, "Do you understand what they just said? like, can you, and my dad's young, he's 62. And he said, yeah. And I said, okay, can you say it back to us? Like what you understand. And it was so different than what the cardiologist had just said.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think sometimes, like you said, we're so willing to just accept what was said, even if we don't understand it, and move along because we want to be seen as like a good patient, right?
A good patient, yeah.
Yes, yes. So I love that B of bringing back up. It's so important.
So important. And I think one thing that you said that I really wish a lot more people did was ask, do you understand, and use that teach back.
Yes.
Because like you said, it will reveal like whether or not they truly heard what you said. Mm-hmm. And then I know for me as a nurse, it's so frustrating when the doctor will see my patient come out of the room and I walk in and they have a million questions
right.
that I can't answer. And I'm like, why did you not ask this
yeah.
when the doctor was in front of you? But I guess like just in them taking a second to process and then realizing, oh, I don't understand.
Yes.
So whenever I prep my patients like early in the morning, I say, okay, the doctor or the team is going to round at this time. Let's talk through right now. What are your concerns? And even I've written down on a piece of paper and left it on the bedside so that if they don't remember, and I'll put it in the chart sometimes, like, you know, patient has concerns about 1, 2, 3, 4, so that even the team can read it ahead of time and address it. And then the nurse or whoever's coming in to take care of them after me can also see that as well if they don't remember if that paper at the bedside gets lost. Mm-hmm. So it's very important. And that goes into my C's, which is concise conversations. Mm. It's very easy to be dismissed when you're just, we have word vomit, for lack of a
better. Yes.
We're just blurting out all these things. Nothing's really connected. And sometimes it's not relevant to the person that you're speaking to. So it's very important that you look at, what am I saying? Is this the right person that I'm saying it to? And is this relevant to what we're talking about? So that's why I created a toolkit or a tool where it can help patients organize the information that's relevant and even have it written down in one place that they can then hand over depending on the circumstance, especially like coming from the emergency department where you have like 2 minutes to tell your triage nurse what's going on. And then you have to repeat that story oftentimes like 3 times to the different people that are coming into your care. So how can we concisely summarize what's happening, what our expectations are, so that we're not dismissed and that nothing's forgotten? That's truly important. And it is a skill that we may not all have for a number of reasons. So the last thing is the D, which is detailed documentation. We have a saying in nursing, if it's not documented, it didn't happen.
So right.
How do we then keep things organized? If you're a transplant patient, you have an interdisciplinary team made up of different providers and specialists that are involved in your care. And you now have to keep track of all the appointments, who said what, because unfortunately, especially in Ontario, we have a system where like, if you're going from different hospitals to hospitals, they don't talk to each other. So It is very hard to keep your care cohesive. So you have to be that person that has all the information and can relay it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So how do we then keep everything organized together? But then also for yourself from an advocacy piece, if say you're requesting a test or you have questions about a treatment and you feel like you're being dismissed, or maybe I've had friends who have been asking for specific referrals that were denied, and It took years for them to get a diagnosis from a referral that should have happened years ago. And truly, like, referrals, in my opinion, should not be denied, especially if they're relevant. And conversations can be had with patients, but oftentimes they're just flat out no's with no rhyme or reason. So having that documentation and asking for it, well, can you document that you're refusing this referral that I requested? And sometimes I'll shift the conversation. Or can you, you know, even like the case with your dad, can you actually put into writing what we just talked about? Or like, give me a second, I just want to write certain things down that you've said, or give me a printout from the system with like the medications that you're recommending and some of the tests that you want me to do. And also another added layer, asking for that accessibility piece. We're in the age of technology. So asking, hey, is it possible to have this translated in my native tongue? Because English is a language. Things like that, like we've, in our Epic system at my first hospital, we were able to translate their discharge summary into different languages by just
Writing.
But a lot of people either didn't know that or patients wouldn't ask. So
yeah,
that was really helpful for some people. So I think that having documentation truly helps you stay organized, helps you advocate for yourself, and then also gives you a reference point when you're going through your complex journey of what is happening, who said what, and what trajectory are you on, and what is your care plan. So those are the ABCDs of advocacy that I've come up with to help patients stay organized and advocate for themselves so they can have the best possible outcomes despite what's happening in our system right now.
I love it. That's amazing. I want to end on a positive note. You know, if you could think about this healthcare world that we're living in right now, if you could reimagine healthcare for systematically repressed groups, what would it look like? Like, what steps would need to happen to make that perfect healthcare world actually a reality?
So I think that the goal would be to have healthcare that is inclusive from the ground up. So that means not designing services for a community, but with them. Having the necessary folks at the table where providers are also being trained on anti-racism and actually collecting data, like health data, that can inform the different educational tools that we're using and is embedded right from the get-go, whether that's medical school, nursing school, and all the other regulatory bodies and professions that are involved in the healthcare system, where cultural safety isn't a nice gesture, but it is a requirement, and patients feel empowered. I think now that I've worked in different provinces, having seamless navigation, so having a cohesive system that is not fragmented, where we're also tracking outcomes, health outcomes that are published transparently. So we're actually able to access the data. We're able to see, like, where are we at? What are the gaps? What is being done? Because I think sometimes the frustration from patients and providers comes from feeling like we're not making progress or things aren't in the works or being done, and that this is just the status quo. So I think the first steps would be collecting race data. And being able to commit to data equity. So we're actually building that data into the governance of our healthcare system for sure. We also need leadership that is actually going to buy in and that is going to value working with communities, value their lived experiences, value qualitative data as well as quantitative data, and truly commit to like implementing different initiatives, having resources available so that all patients can participate equally into the healthcare system, and making sure that this is something that is ongoing. It's not a one and done. We've done this. We've had this program. Okay, let's evaluate it. Is it working? We've invested a lot. Are we seeing the return on investment? Are we seeing patients truly being supported? So I think that reimagining healthcare to me isn't just about treating bodies. It's actually about restoring dignity, healing trust, and honoring every person's story and seeing them as a person that is worthy of care.
That's incredible. That's amazing. I want to live in that reimagined healthcare world for sure.
Me too.
And I don't think it's something that can happen. You know, I think, you know, as I started in this world, you know, about 14, 15 years ago, and I've seen so much change. It just, I think sometimes we think it's not happening quick enough, right? And it's not for these, for these reasons that we've talked about today. But having people like you, you know, talking about this and empowering patients and having people be able to listen about ways that they can raise their voice as well. And listening as providers, you know, I have had some situations where I've talked to people and they've said, well, you know, if this group of patient wants change, then they should go in and do that. And it always, you know, puts a fire under me because I recognize that my transplant journey was a really easy, seamless one. And I had everything that I needed to make that journey happen. And I'm one of the very, very lucky ones. And I'm very grateful for that. And I have so many friends and, you know, being part of this transplant world now, knowing all of the barriers that people go through, not just in transplant care, but like we talked about today, just in being part of this system. And I think if we don't stand up and try to make action when we have power like that, like you talked about the leaders, things are not going to change because we really need to use the power that we have individually to make that change. And I'm wondering, you know, somebody who is not part of a group who has been systematically repressed, you know, someone who has the privilege that I do, what are some things that I can do, you know, to build this up and to help in these communities?
I think that as someone who also has privilege and was one of the lucky ones in my journey, I've actually had the pleasure of caring for a patient that had the same tumor as me, but their journey was very different. And even just the sense of when I came in and she was like starting to tell me about it and was like, oh, like, I know you've probably never heard of this, and started talking about it. I was like, oh, like, between you and I have, and I have it. And the conversation was so different. And just in that moment, I felt privileged to be standing, walking, and being able to do a lot of the things that I can do versus they weren't so fortunate in terms of their journey. And I recognized, like, okay, I have privilege. Let's look at how I can use that to help others. So one, being open to being called in and called out and called out. So being able to have the humility and willingness to learn and grow when I don't get it right. And I think that's important for a lot of folks, not to get defensive, not to be dismissive when you're being held accountable or you're told that, hey, like, you did something that was offensive or that was racist, was discriminatory, and this is how you can fix it. So not othering people, like in the example that you gave, well, that group needs to fix it. No, we all have a responsibility. Yeah. And having that community approach to care. I think that calling out is very important. And when we're in these spaces, regardless of that's at work, at home, even with your children, when you hear certain things that come home from the playground, mm-hmm. looking at, okay, how can I speak up for people whose voices have been repressed for generations? How can I stand in front of them and use my privilege to make a difference? So that might be, hey, you made a comment or a joke in the break room that was a little insensitive. Let's not do that. Or I've gotten a report and people will be like, oh, this patient's a good patient. No, let's not do that. And mm-hmm. I think that can also be like a little bit isolating, or that can, when we label people as difficult. So just, I try in the moment, even though it might be a little bit uncomfortable, but I try to do it in the most casual way as possible so that we can actually normalize it. It doesn't have to necessarily be a huge conversation, but just being like, hey, like, come on, let's not say that, because it truly will contribute to this generalizing, stereotyping, and bias. And sometimes in that moment, when you say that, it might be the first time that they've ever been called in. Mm-hmm. And it truly can start a process for somebody to for them to think about, hey, why did I say that? What views do I hold? Am I biased? We're all capable of that regardless of our backgrounds. And looking at how you can, when you have privilege, usually that means there's a loss of power. Like, you have power and privilege, but then there's a loss of power and privilege for another group. So for example, being in an English speaking country and English is my first language, I have a lot of privilege, but that also means that there's a lot of people who don't. So how can I then use that to even the playing field or help advocate for them? And that might be, hey, like sitting on a committee at work. And I think a lot of the work that you do, even with the ACB community, shows like you're very committed to learning about different people's journeys and what are the gaps in the system. And you've been able to see that with the patients that you talk to and the different spaces that you occupy, and use your voice to, and your time to actually create avenues for folks to be heard, create avenues for policies and changes to come about so that we're not going to continue to perpetuate harm. We're not going to continue to marginalize folks. And we're going to actually try to improve the healthcare system. And that really just starts with what we use our voices and our time to do. So I think it's also simple again in those ways.
Amazing. Well, I could talk to you for 3 days, but I want to say thank you so much for this conversation and taking the time again to talk about all of these amazing things that you're doing. We're going to link in the notes some of your websites that people can take a look at, and I'll also link your episode for the Green Table Talk so people can listen to that as well, because it was wonderful. But again, thank you so much. Love getting to talk to you and spend time with you. It's always such a joy.
Thank you, Candace. It's truly been a pleasure just getting to know you over the past, I think, year now, and working with you on so many different projects. And I truly can't wait to see more of the work that you're going to do and the work that we can do together as well. So thank you for being a part of this space and being a part of the solution.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.